Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Unleash the Power of Free Enterprise to Deliver Fuel to the Future. Today's guest is Mr. Bob Inglis. Bob Inglis is a former congressman from South Carolina. He is here today to talk about how Republicans can take the lead on three issues of great importance: energy, clean air, and climate. Everyone in this room knows that Utah needs to do something about the quality of our air during winter inversions and in the heat of summer. Bob's free enterprise and market-based solutions just might be the answer. Bob Inglis directs the Energy and Enterprise Initiative based at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Inglis, a conservative Republican, represented South Carolina's 4th District in the U.S. Congress from 1993 to 1999 and again from 2005 to 2011. Sponsors of this event include the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the Stegner Center, the Nature Conservancy, Citizens Climate Lobby, and Utah Interfaith Power and Light. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you, Kendall, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. Wow, I'm excited about being in Utah. This is my first time in Utah. So can I come back for skiing? Is there an invitation? Lift tickets? No, I guess it doesn't extend that far. Huh? But it really is very exciting to be here, and particularly exciting to see such a diverse crowd. We've got students, we've got professors, we've got people from town, I suppose. So, and elsewhere.
If you can bring the Republicans on board to stop climate change, we'll give you a lifetime pass.
All right, hey, good. Hey, all right. So, stakes are high. I've got to make this work, all right? So here's what I'm here to say, is that the champions of free enterprise are apparently dealing with an inferiority complex that we must overcome. We have people in my party, conservatives, who have this very undeserved inferiority complex. We apparently think we're no good at energy and climate. But actually, as I'll describe here soon, we're very good at it. So, first I should tell you a little bit about how I come to this, right? Because you're probably wondering, now, who again is this guy speaking? Kendall told you some about me, but let me give you a little bit of fill in some of the texture there. I represented probably the reddest district in the reddest state. Now, I'm thinking that there's some in Utah that are going to fight me for that honor. But we'll match you. You've got BYU, we've got BJU, Bob Jones University. You've got conservatives. Well, we seceded from the nation, I would remind you. And we have gone to arms over this point. You haven't done that yet, have you? So I think that I think we're the reddest district in the reddest state, all right? And so... So I represented the district for 6 years, and I was out 6 years doing commercial real estate law again, and then I ran again for another 6 years. I thought it was going to be a lot longer than 6 years. That second go-around, we called it Inglis 2.0, the new and improved version. Unfortunately, there's this tea party that was going on, and I got specifically uninvited to said tea party in June of 2010. So Senator Bennett and I now hang out together at the R Street Institute. We're both on the board of R Street, and it's a wonderful think tank in Washington. R apparently stands for rejects. We're Republican rejects. They should call it the R Street Institute, Republican rejects. But anyhow, so... But I want you to know, a pretty conservative fellow, right? So anybody that's in the crowd is now going to start, I'm going to start dividing up the crowd, right? Because you're going to think, oh, gee, we thought he was with us, but now we're finding out this guy is really right-wing, reactionary conservative. 93 American Conservative Union rating. It's not my friend Jim DeMint's 100, but it's a pretty good one. I mean, 93 is an A. Is that an A at Utah?
It's an A.
It's an A? Okay, good. So 93 American Conservative Union, 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the NRA, zero with the ADA, Americans for Democratic Action, and 23 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO. I really wanted a zero. I once said that in front of a crowd in Washington. Lo and behold, the AFL-CIO political director was there. He got up, walked toward the organizer of the event. I didn't know this was going on. She apparently was rather stunned by him coming toward her after I'd said those words. He handed his card to her, and on the back it said, "Tell Inglis I'll buy him a drink, and we'll talk about that recount." So I haven't taken him up on it yet. I want the recount. I want it down from 23 to zero, please. So pretty conservative fellow, right? I'm somewhat right now a little bit out of sync with what travels as conservatism with my party in saying that it's actually quite conservative to be concerned about climate change, that it's actually quite liberal to proceed in the face of risk pell-mell, that it really makes a lot more sense in terms of conservative personality and philosophy to be cognizant of the risk and to ask, is there anything we can do to move against that risk? And so that's what I'm doing nowadays. I'm trying to prepare the country or be part of this effort to prepare the country for a free enterprise solution on energy and climate. And that starts with equipping the champions of free enterprise, Republicans, conservatives, libertarians, to lead this discussion. So far, we've been largely shrinking in science denial. And I think that's because we have this inferiority complex. We just think we're no good at energy and climate. I'm going to describe for you a vision, a goal, a strategy, and a tactic. And then you see if you agree, if you're a conservative here, that we can actually lead this, that we should actually be the ones leading. Now, I will right off the bat here say that there are a number of progressives who would agree with what I'm about to say. Don't tell any conservatives, okay? These are Shia versus Sunni times. We behead one another, all right? So if you're a progressive, don't give me away. Don't tell them that you actually agree with me. Best thing you can do is go issue a press release saying that Neanderthal conservative Inglis came to the University of Utah. We didn't agree with anything he had to say. That would actually help us, probably. All right? So quietly agree if you want to. But if you're a conservative, please join with us in going out there and preparing the champions of free enterprise to actually lead this. So at the vision level, Newt Gingrich used to tell us, I was in Congress for 6 years, gone 6 years, came back for another six, as just said. So in that first 6 years, that's when Newt Gingrich, became speaker. Newt used to tell us, and those were the good days when Newt was really solid in a lot of ways. And so we did some good work, I think, involving his leadership that said basically what you want to do is talk about vision, goals, strategies, and tactics. And you want to listen, learn, help, and lead. And so what I'm about to describe is our vision, followed by the goals, the strategies, and the tactics. So the vision here is to light up the world with abundant, affordable, sustainable energy. This is where I could ask for a show of hands. It would be interesting to see. You could track along with me. I could have asked right at the outset, raise your hand and keep your hand up as long as you can agree with me, right? Because on this first point, we'll have some disagreement. There's some people who say that, no, we need to live with less. Well, that's not the point we're making. We're making exactly the opposite point, which is we want more energy, not less. We want more convenience, not less. We want more mobility, not less. So we're not in the walk and eat bugs crowd. Some people are in that crowd. It's not our group. We're in the folks that say, no, listen, we sort of like the idea of being able to fly from South Carolina to Utah. We like the idea of having the convenience of automobiles that get us around real easily and nice comfort. We like all that. And we like the idea and find it a moral imperative to light up Africa so that they don't have to stop working when the sun goes down. They could actually read on into the night and telecommunicate with the rest of the world and add their productivity and insights and creativity to the whole world. If they do, what a better place this is going to be. So we take it as a moral imperative to light up the world with abundant, affordable, sustainable energy. Their goal, supporting that vision, is to have free enterprise drive it. Now, at this point, I could have asked for a show of hands to see, okay, keep your hands up as long as you can agree with me. Some people would say, no, really, this needs to be a regulatory answer. We need wise ones to figure out good regulations, an appropriate cap on emissions, and then we got to agree to live underneath that cap because the wise ones have set it at that level, and now we will live in that regime. That's a respectable point of view. It's not our point of view at the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. Our point of view is that, no, we want this to be free enterprise driven. And so that puts us at odds, by the way, with President Obama's regulatory approach on CO2. We think it is precisely the worst way to try to reduce global emissions because it is cumbersome. And it is prone to evasion. And after the slog of domestic litigation that he goes through, he will achieve a price on carbon. It'll be a regulatory price, which is, again, the most cumbersome, most inefficient way to do it. But it'll be a domestic-only price. And that's really bad news. Because what that means is that as energy prices rise in America, we will lose productive capacity to higher energy-intensive locations and countries. The result will be not only do we lose jobs, but we increase global emissions. So what we take as a challenge is you got to figure out how to make it so a system such that China and India would want to be in compliance with it. Because lacking that, what you end up is the leakage that many in the climate community are worried about, which is you end up with an increase in global emissions, actually. So we're looking for a free enterprise. So the vision, again, is that that lighting up the world. The goal is to use free enterprise to do it. And to support that goal, the reason is that we think that free enterprise is faster and more efficient and more creative than government regulations. And the proof of that is the cell phone that you have in your pocket. The internet and the PC. Those actually started with government action. That's why I'm a Republican, by the way, not a libertarian. There used to be a difference. It started with some government action, but then once it became a profit motive and incentive, wow, did it move quickly. Cost crashes, penetration in the marketplace, because there were people who had customers that were driving the demand for it. So that model is what we want to pursue in energy, right? So vision is that lighting up the world. The goal is to use free enterprise. The strategy for us is to price carbon. And we want to do that through a revenue-neutral carbon tax. I realize, now that I've said that, I notice that the ground has not swallowed up, not opened and swallowed me up. I'm still alive and speaking to you. I've said the words revenue-neutral carbon tax. I will tell you, if you're running for Congress, a better thing to say is you're going to do a tax swap. Because If you say revenue neutral, I mean, what is that? It sounds like it's from government, you know, revenue neutral. Nobody says that except somebody that's from the government. It means that if there's a tax on carbon, we cut taxes somewhere else, of course. But also the problem is if you're running in a pretty red state, that's Utah, right? Not as red as you understand in South Carolina, but if you're running in Utah, you probably don't want to go around talking about a carbon tax because carbon will cause conservatives to break out in hives and tax will drive them in anaphylactic shock. So if you can say tax swap, if you can say swap quickly enough after the word tax, you avoid the anaphylactic reaction. And so what you want to talk about is when you're out on the hustings, if you're running for a Republican nomination for Congress here in Utah, is talk about a tax swap. And the person to cite maybe is Art Laffer, Ronald Reagan's economics advisor, who says on our website, if you go to energyandenterprise.com, I hope particularly people watching on the web will go to energyandenterprise.com, and is written out. You'll see a two-minute video featuring Art Laffer, President Reagan's economics advisor, who says essentially he doesn't know whether climate change is real or not. He says he's agnostic. I'm a believer. He's agnostic. But he says he doesn't need to know whether it's real. All he needs to know is you're taxing something you want more of, which is income. And you're not taxing something you maybe want less of, which is carbon pollution. So he says it's a no-brainer. Change what you tax. And in normal times, conservatives would see that and say, yeah, that certainly makes sense, doesn't it? We have a whole bunch of incentive-destroying taxes on capital and labor that restrain capital and labor and that make it so that you don't get the rewards of that work or that investment. So why not untax that and tax something else? Do this tax swap. The strategy here is to price carbon through a revenue-neutral carbon tax. There are only two imperatives for us at the Energy Enterprise Initiative. One is that it be revenue-neutral, which I've already mentioned, and that means that we can't grow the government here. It's one of the reasons that I voted against cap-and-trade. I think cap-and-trade is hopelessly complicated, embarrassing in the free allocations of the well-connected, decimate American manufacturing, and a massive tax increase. So for all those reasons, I thought it was a non-starter. I had the temerity, or maybe the foolishness, to introduce an alternative, which is this revenue-neutral carbon tax, the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. When I saw that recently in something I was writing, I typed in 2009, I thought, gee, Manny Inglis, what were you thinking? That is in the teeth of the Great Recession, talking about something, a massive change. That was not a very good political move, I suppose, but I had this idea that if you're going to oppose something called cap and trade, you need to propose something better. You can't just oppose. If you're going to lead, you have to propose as well. So, one of the imperatives is to be revenue neutral, as I mentioned. In the bill that I introduced, it would have cut payroll taxes, but we are quite ecumenical on this point. If you want to cut corporate income taxes in replacement for the if we're going to put a price on carbon through carbon tax, if the offsetting cut is to corporate income taxes, we're for you. If it's personal income taxes, we're for you. If it's payroll taxes, we're also for you. That was my bill. If it's a dividend where we're going to return the money, sort of Alaska Oil Fund style, back to the people, we're for you. All of those are fine with us at the Energy Enterprise Initiative. They're all revenue neutral, and it's just essential, though, that we be revenue neutral, because the communities that we're trying to reach, if it's not revenue neutral, it contributes to the growth of government, and that is just not acceptable to conservatives. So revenue neutrality is one imperative for us. The second is it be a border adjustable tax. That means that it would be rebated on exports and imposed on imports from countries that don't similarly price carbon. If they have a similar price on carbon, then there'd be no border adjustment. The goods would come right in. We have no intention of being trade punitive here. We just need to make the point, though, that if we have this leakage problem and we export this productive capacity to higher energy intensive locations, you actually end up with larger, greater global emissions and unemployment here. So it's very important that it be this border adjustable feature. By the way, for any trade lawyers here, we recognize that there is a WTO question there. But I would submit that it's not as big a question as the domestic litigation question that the president faces on his Clean Air Act regulations. So if he's got a litigation slog, we know we've got one through the WTO. But we think there are very good arguments about why it is WTO compliant. And we've got some folks that are allies in that area. So so the sum of this, and then I'll stop and answer your questions, hear your comments. The sum of this really is that we're looking for a true cost comparison between competing fuels. And that's all we're looking for. And what I'm talking about true cost is that means getting the government out of the business of picking winners and losers. No more cylindras. No more production tax credit for wind. No more investment tax credits for various things. But also no under-market leases on public land. And also no accelerated depreciation and other special tax benefits for oil and gas. It's basically just get the government out of the business of subsidizing or choosing winners and losers, and then have the government's only role being the honest cop on the beat who attaches all of the cost to all the fuels through a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And so the idea here for the economists present, I'm not an economist, your profession talk about is internalizing the negative externalities, basically taking these negative effects, negative externalities, and putting them on the product so the product can be judged in an efficient marketplace. That's all we're looking for. The thing that holds us back, and this is the last thing I'd mention, is this, told you the vision, our goal, our strategies, our tactics. A tactic, which maybe you can help us with here, is that while what I've just described in that true cost comparison is bedrock conservatism, it is exactly what conservatives of the Republican type and of the Libertarian type very passionately believe. Yet there is this cultural rejection of action on energy and climate. And that's the nub of the action is, right? Is whether there is this going to continue to be this rejection of action, because somehow it offends some cultural or faith norm or something down deep that says, no, it can't be. And so it's we acknowledge we're operating in a very strange environment, really, because, this issue, energy and climate, is a low salience, high complexity issue. It's low salience. If you look at any polling data, you'll see that almost nobody cares about energy and climate. They care only about jobs in the economy right now. When the economy is doing well, then healthcare and education sort of come toward the top of that list of priorities. But right now, it's at the bottom of everybody's list is action on energy and climate. So it's low salience, high complexity. Because modeling these systems, the entire world climate system, that's pretty tough, right? It's very complex. Normally, a low salience, high complexity issue would be interesting only to academics, right? Because who else cares? It's just people that spend their lives or got their PhD in that area that spend time on those issues. But this one has become a cultural marker. And that is an unusual turn of events. Contrast it to, say, action on acid rain. Acid rain was low salience. Unless you were an avid hiker or in the timber industry, you probably didn't even notice that there was a problem with acid rain. It's fairly high complexity, or at least the science is beyond me. But it never became a cultural marker, so it just got done. The solution was had, and got some, a few, not very many companies in the room, did a cap-and-trade program. By the way, the reason that cap-and-trade works is it's very few point sources and very few emitters, and the result was you could cap it, you could trade underneath that cap, work fine. This thing we're talking about with CO2 has literally billions of point sources, and it's why I'm with the camp of economists who say a price signal is more effective when you've got that scenario. But the contrast, the thing that's interesting in this tactical, the last point I'm making to this tactical point, is how do we move this from this, how do we drain the cultural charge out of this so that we can think straight about it? And that we, more like acid rain, can say, okay, we got a problem. Here's a solution. On this one, we've got a problem, or maybe we don't have a problem. That's where the debate is, right? And our challenge in Energy and Enterprise Initiative is to convince conservatives that perceiving the problem does not lead to the assumed solution of a bigger government that taxes you more, that takes away your liberty, and that regulates your life. What we need to prove to the champions of free enterprise is there's a different solution that involves the liberty of enlightened self-interest, where people signaled by a price on carbon would make their own decisions, and the result would be there'd be a consumer-driven demand for innovation, like with your cell phones. And so the result would be a change, a huge change, rapid change, that would result in the things that the scientists want, which is reduced emissions, things that capitalists want, which is wealth creation in all these businesses and new innovations, and things that people, for example, of faith want, which is to take this opportunity to light up Africa, for example, and to bring the opportunities to places that previously have been dark. So let me stop there and see what questions or comments you have about what I've been saying here.
Please state your name and a little bit about yourself, and then just speak clearly into the mic.
My name is Jerry Wilmore. I'm a leadership trainer, and I used to work back in D.C. for Senator Church, so I'm familiar with the federal government. I've been back here for about 20 years, and what I've noticed is that all the attempts to use the free market always succumb to the realities of the free market. Number one, most of the elements on there are subsidized, chief among which are coal and oil. Right. Two, it doesn't price these elements honestly. And three, it always looks for the short term. There's not a stock on the free market, so-called, that is interested in a profit 100 years from now. It's this quarter, this year. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, great question. It's a huge challenge, right? It's like, it's cathedral building, basically, is what we're talking about. You know, the people that built the cathedrals in Europe that laid the cornerstone would never see it finished. And so the question is, can human beings think that far ahead? Well, yes, apparently we can. We built cathedrals. Can the capitalistic system that we've got now do that? I happen to think no, unless it's constrained by some sort of a moral consensus. And that's what's, I think, off topic here, I guess. But the capitalist system is a great system in a fallen world, provided it's constrained by a moral kind of ethic. If it's not, then it becomes runaway greed, and it really is rather ugly. And you do maximize short-term profits and forget the rest. But in the presence of some sort of moral underpinning, capitalism can be a great system. But that has something to do with, I guess, our faith and moral teachings, is whether we can preserve that restraining element on capitalism. But otherwise, you're right. I was about to say something about China, about whether you can, you know, just become just an absolute capitalist and just go for it, unconstrained by, care of the future. And They're trying, and without respect for human rights and liberty, they're trying. I hope that experiment gets corrected and they realize the importance of recognizing human rights and individual dignity, and that they actually on this case, though, back to the main point of climate change, they may actually be interested in acting now. Because of a felt need. It's sort of like the felt need that you have here in Salt Lake City about, you know, when you can't go outside. You know, even repressive Chinese dictators who have a child who wants to go out and play soccer, who can't, that has an impact on you, even if you're that repressive Chinese communist dictator. And so you start thinking maybe a little bit about the future. And then hopefully you go find some faith or moral tradition that tells you to honor that deeply, and then you get with it and you build a cathedral and you start impacting the future. I realize that last part's a dreamer, and I'm a little bit off economics there, but you're right to raise, you know, the question about, is it just economics? No, it involves something else as well.
My name is Thunder Jalili. I'm an outlier in this group because I'm an associate professor in the College of Health. And so I'm not a political scientist. I don't really know that much about politics. But from a citizen perspective, I think your solutions seem pretty reasonable. And it's something that I would like to see move forward. But when I look at the way our government functions and the way the two parties function, they don't seem to function. They're dysfunctional. And what you propose has a lot of political implications for the coal industry, for the ethanol industry. Right. Is it realistic to go forward with this? Because Washington can't seem to solve anything. Can you comment on some of that?
Yeah, great question. Right, and it's appropriate to ask it in the context of political science department. Right, is it possible? Here's my view. Congress nearly perfectly reflects the will of the American people. I know that's not what we like to hear. We like to say, no, they don't listen to me. They don't listen to us. They just do what they want to do. But I'm here to tell you, I think Congress really does listen very carefully to the people. And they give us just exactly what we want. So we want a balanced budget, right? But don't touch my Social Security or my parents' Social Security or their Medicare. And don't touch my niece who is Down syndrome's Medicaid, all right? Gotcha. You want us to talk and do nothing. We're right to get at that in Washington. And so they hear me. Balance the budget. But don't do anything about Mom and Dad's Social Security, Medicare, and Paige's Medicaid. And so, all right, got it. Got the message. On climate change, they hear the same thing. You know, really should do something about that. But for goodness sakes, don't change our energy mix and don't get into the business of affecting my price I'm paying at my meter. I don't want to know the real price of electricity. No, I'd prefer not to know. And so they say, gotcha. We'll talk and do nothing. Good at that. And so they do exactly what we want them to do. And so the question is whether we as citizens, and this is why I'm happy to be here with Citizens Climate Lobby, for example, they understand that citizens actually getting together can have an impact on elected officials. Another political science observation is that politicians don't lead, they follow. So what we have to do is show them support, and they will follow. But, you know, otherwise what they say is, yo, Inglis, how'd that work out for you, man? You said here, you gotta go. I got a great idea. We can go price carbon. Oh, terrific! And how'd that work out when you walked in and said, "Here's what we got a great plan for you. We're gonna increase your electricity rates. We're gonna increase the price at the pump. We're gonna increase your natural gas prices." Inglis for Congress. That didn't work out too well, right? So the way to start that again, if you're running for Congress in Utah, is to start with a tax cut and say that we're going to cut taxes on income, and then, by the way, in order to fund the government, we've got to make it up somewhere else. So here's the thing that I know, too, from the financial crisis, is that necessity is a mother invention, or another way to put it, as somebody put it in the financial crisis, isn't it amazing how quickly the impossible went to the inevitable without ever passing through the probable. And that's what I think can happen on this issue, is it in the context of action on the story. Now I'm going to tell you how we can get this done, right? In the context of, and answer your specific question about how do you get this done? I mean, come on. It's like this. We got a structural deficit. At some point, New York calls Washington and says, no, really, do something. That's not happened yet. All we've had is Washington talking to itself about that structural deficit. But when New York calls Washington and says, do you see what's happening in the bond market? Do you see that Europe is, let's posit this situation, is recovering? They're becoming relatively more attractive, not more attractive than us, but relatively more than they have been attractive for investment. Result is that our bond prices, interest rates being bid up. We're being exposed to our risk of repayment. It's being made apparent that we've got a risk of repayment. And so as the bond, as the interest rate rises, New York is calling Washington, and that's when you get action. Because now it's real world and people looking for a solution, right? And so in the context of structural deficit changes, which would you rather do? Do you want to tax income more? Or would you like to lighten up on taxes on income and tax something we want less of? At that point, if we've been successful in that fourth thing I mentioned, that strategic work that we're trying to do about draining the cultural charge, then perhaps the champions of free enterprise would hear Art Laffer saying, hey, change what you tax. When you get in that room and you're doing that structural deficit, change what you tax. Now, you're on to something very important, which is there's some people that want to make it so that that conclusion won't come out of that meeting. In fact, we had one of our detractors, and we've got them, and they are well-funded for the reasons that you would suspect, having just identified some of the culprits of people who would fund the opposition to this. One of them said very publicly, you know, the problem is when they get in a room and they start talking about this and they get people like Greg Mankiw, Art Laffer, R. Glenn Hubbard in the room, they can be quite persuasive. Well, you bet they can be persuasive with conservatives because they are talking bedrock free enterprise and conservatism. And so there's some people out there that are trying to make sure that those circuits never connect. And they're working overtime. And they like to squash us like an ant on the sidewalk. And we, compared to their funding, are the ant, and they are the giant that's walking along trying to get us. But you know what? A giant is not so agile as the ant, so we're trying to run in front of them. And hopefully it's going to work. That was a long answer to your question, wasn't it? But I gave you the whole lay of the land. It's how it could happen as a structural deficit reform.
So hi. Before I introduce myself, before I forget, how come New York didn't call D.C. after Sandy? Thought about that. But I'm Kevin Leecaster, a geologist, another one who's not a political scientist. But I did grow up in Arlington, so I've been around politics a while, or I've seen it. Anyways, you brought up mainly the moral imperative, and then your trip out here and giving talks like this is part of the tactic. Can you go over any other tactics on how to help get who we want in office from, which is how this has got to be addressed? Thanks.
Yeah. Well, of course, we're a 501c3, so we don't get involved in politics. I won't answer that question in terms of how to do it in politics, but I will tell you in terms of ideas. Is just this is a country that usually seeks solutions. I think Tom Friedman had it right in The World is Flat. He says, America is the only country young enough and brash enough to believe that every problem has a solution. He writes there that, you know, Europe long ago gave up that idea. But that's who we are. And that's you know, to whom much is given, much will be required. We, America the blessed, exists to be a blessing, and we should be about these solutions. And we will be about those solutions once we get through the pain of the Great Recession. This is a temporary problem associated with the pain of the Great Recession. That we in politics, if you use my electoral condition as a measuring life, in 2000, I was in 6 years, out 6 years, came back in 2004, ran again, right? Got 85% of the primary vote in 2004, even though I had announced energy security as my number one priority. A little bit weird English, but go ahead, is what they basically said to me. 2006, still fine. 2008, thank goodness the Republican primary was in June, not in September, October, because that's when the collapse was happening. But I had a primary opponent in 08 who called me the Al Gore of the Republican Party. He didn't mean it as a compliment. it started to stick, right? And so in 10, I lost in that primary and only got 29% of the vote. The other guy that got elected got 71% of the vote, right? And so that's what happened in the Great Recession. I mean, you can see it. In 2004, things are pretty good. Inglis, that's fine. Go talk about energy security. Besides, we've got General Electric here making wind turbines. We got BMW. It means, by the way, Bubba makes wheels. That's what BMW means. So BMW makes cars, and they were talking about hydrogen cars at the time because George Bush was also talking about them. And we've got Michelin's North American headquarters, a fabulous company that makes low rolling resistance tires. For all those reasons, there's this wonderful local connection to energy security, right? All fine, 04 great, 06 still fine, 08 collapse comes, uh-uh. We are now busted to the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We're not talking about self-actualization, moving to energy security. We are talking about this month's mortgage, this month's paycheck. Inglis, you're talking about something a decade or two away. Get out of here. So in the immediacy, it's a problem. But if we can get people breathing again and feeling that, okay, we can face the future and we can go forward as these Americans who can solve problems, then it won't be quite that behead them kind of situation you're describing. Yeah, that's me.
Hi. So I'm Jen Colby, and I'm the sustainability coordinator here at the university. Yeah. And I wanted to thank you for coming today, and also thank you for your moral courage as an elected official being willing to speak out, even though perhaps you knew that this wasn't the most politically wise sort of thing to have those sort of principles and be willing to potentially lose your job over that. So I find that admirable and appreciate you continuing to speak out on this. Quick comment and a question. I guess I do see, I don't want to be terribly cynical about what we as citizens believe or are willing to pay for, and I work with a lot of groups and a lot of people from a very diverse array of communities, including the business community here, which is very active and very supportive of many changes, and they recognize in many ways that we need to pay the real costs of what we're doing and are willing to pay for it if it's structured properly. So that comes around to the question of polluter pays. That was a bedrock principle for decades and has been undermined largely by the lobbying by those who actually are the polluters who are paying.
Right.
And so my question is, while I can see where revenue neutral is incredibly persuasive for those who might not be willing to see something like a tax, there's also a large component of damage that's already been done, and that's not just carbon, from a lot of our economically driven activities. Would you support a net revenue neutral proposal? For example, how do we pay for Sandy and the pass-throughs from FEMA to private entities that have been damaged through the extreme weather sorts of things? Can we take those costs, build those in, pay for those costs, and then be revenue neutral? Would that be something you'd be willing to support?
Mm-hmm. I think it basically goes to sort of the issue of whether you can make up past damage. It's pretty difficult to calculate, I would think. I mean, you can calculate it, I suppose. I'm not sure that, well, actually, let me answer it going forward. Going forward, it's like this. I think I'm not an economist. I need some help from, I'm going to throw a lifeline to an economist here who might be able to help me. Is basically what you want to do is you want to price carbon at the marginal harm, not greater, not less. Because if you price greater, then you're shutting down economic activity. If you price less, then you're allowing some people to socialize costs while privatizing profits, and that creates inefficiencies. And so the answer would be, no, I wouldn't want to go back and add that legacy cost onto it, because then you're not what we should be mostly focused on is how can we affect behavior going forward? Because it's sort of like my mother used to say to me, you know, well, if you hadn't done such and so, Bob, we wouldn't be here. I know that, Mom. What do we do now? You know, you know, there are a lot of things I could have done better if I hadn't gotten myself into that situation. But now we're in the situation. What do we do going forward? And going forward, I think you want to look at the marginal harm or marginal cost and try to attach that to the product and then just hope for grace on the other and for education and things get better on the other. I realize that's not where you'd go with that, but I think it's the most efficient way forward. It's sort of like, you could stop congestion in New York City. This was pointed out to us by Michael Boskin at Stanford. He said on this point that you could... he was making the point to me, helping me to understand. He's an economist, helping me understand that you want to price it at the marginal harm. Because he says you could stop congestion in New York City by charging, say, $1,000 per vehicle to enter Manhattan. But you would also shut down economic activity. So the marginal harm is not $1,000 per vehicle. It's something far less than that. So you want to price it at that marginal level. Now, the question is, what is that marginal harm? And that is really hard to get to. And at the end of the day, it becomes not just an economics question, but a value question. And that's the reality that we've all got to face in a free society is we have to make this decision about what is the social cost of carbon, right? Because at the end of the day, that is some economics, but it's also some value judgment. And so that's – but if we could get to that debate – rather than struggling through denial, I'd happily go into that debate. Let's move to the debate and out of the denial, right?
Hi, Bob. My name's Chris Cherniak. I'm an environmental engineer and consultant, and I also host a radio show on environmental issues, which, shameless plug, Bob was kind enough to spend a couple of minutes talking about. It's out of Park City, KPCW. I really like your idea of cathedral building, and because is it really too late to convince and compel the Inhofs and the Coburns and the Bachmans and the Rohrabachers of the world that climate and carbon really is an issue? And isn't this more about the next generation of conservatives coming on board to recognize that they can have conservative principles and care about the environment and be good environmental stewards?
Yeah. I think that this is, I think things are really moving here. I know you might decide that I'm, you know, that English guy really is a dreamer. I mean, he's, but I think things are moving here and that we're actually starting to see the cathedral come up. Is that I perceive shrinkage in the three camps, maybe, right? Real and human caused, real, but who knows what causes it, and is it all total hooey? That last category is people are moving out of it into at least the one that says real, but we're not sure what. Because all these wonderful geologists and other people are showing, wait a minute, no, it really is real. And so the hoax category is people are jumping out of there and moving into the other category. And so the reason that I think I have optimism is I think that it's really very much like the patient who has seen something on their skin, they know they need to go see the dermatologist. But they're going through the process of trying to dismiss it as other things. I got bitten by a bug, that's why that's looking like that. I hit myself on a stick, and that's why it's looking different. It's not until our spouse tells us, no, really, you got to go to see the dermatologist. We go to the dermatologist, and we can deal with it. But we go through that process. It's a normal human process of being confronted with an issue, a problem, a challenge, and trying to dismiss it by some other means than have it go off on something other than, no, this is a real problem that we must address, particularly if it involves the pain of, say, going and getting it cut off or something, you know? And so, but eventually we will go and get it cut off. And that's why I think there's migration into at least it's real category, and hopefully we can see people move into the categories as real, human caused, and we can deal with it.
Hello, my name is Satine, and I'm a political science major, and I'm pre-med here at the U. I just wanted to comment and say, and a question, of course, oil is a big part of the United States and has a lot to do with why we're on top. And is responsible for a lot of the economic growth we've had over the past century. But it has also put us in a situation where it's vital to our national security to have sustainable oil always available to us and has involved us a lot in wars abroad. So it is definitely an issue. Our energy is definitely a really big issue that stretches far beyond the perils of climate change. However, you spoke that it's not a really good time right now because the economy is kind of low to do anything about climate change. However, I argue that it is imperative that we move on climate change, and I think I offer that we can use it as a way to grow the economy. In the same way that you spoke about how the cell phone in my pocket came about, it did start with a little bit of a spark of government innovation. In the same way that we went to the moon, it brought up the industry of technology was born because of the race to the moon.
Right.
So I offer the argument that the United States government, rather than growing and taking over the energy industry, should offer a spark in that we should move to research and innovation to allow us to be free from oil, which would solve problems in climate change. We would be back on top economically if everything were to go to plan. Are you opposed to the government taking some sort of initiative and investing in an entirely new industry as opposed to just remedying the one we have now?
Well, I think that, the expansion of supply that came from fracking and natural gas and that is coming from unconventional extraction in petroleum actually sort of proves the point that we're making, that's where you get real innovation, right? I mean, so, for example, right now, 6 coal-fired plants are closing down in South Carolina being replaced by natural gas. The reason is fracking. Fracking expanded the supply, made the price drop. They said, to heck with coal, we're coming with natural gas. And that human ingenuity gave us this wonderful solution, which is now lower emissions in South Carolina than we had, right? So we're for that. The thing that we got to watch in the case of petroleum, I think, is you're raising the strategic significance of oil. And that is, this is something that is going to be the victory that's not a real victory, a pyrrhic victory for us on petroleum, is the unconventional extraction is going to end up with continuation of petroleum as a strategic commodity. This, believe me, does not work well with constituents, all right? But, I mean, I found out this is not a very good argument, but I think it's the truth. The best thing that can happen if you're the Saudi royal family is that America drills more wells and gets all the petroleum it can get. Because the result will be that you extend the life of petroleum as a strategic commodity, and your great-grandchildren get to keep this connected to here. Otherwise, when it's no longer a strategic commodity, that's what happens to you, the royal family. So what you want is America to go drill everything it's got and keep on just relying on petroleum. So what we would say is the answer to that is, okay, let's start pricing the negative externalities associated with petroleum, putting it to the product, and then watch the market gravitate away from it. And that will happen. If you put, for example, the strategic, some of the defense costs, if you did just simple cost accounting, there's probably some business school major here or something that can tell us you can do cost accounting. And you can say some of that defense cost is attributed to the protection of that supply line. Put it on the product. You put it on the product, then, oh, it's not that cheap, huh? That stuff's more dear than I thought. I think I'm interested in a Prius or a Volt. I think I'm interested in some other kind of technology. And then what happens is all kinds of exciting stuff starts happening if the true cost is in. And again, it won't be any regulator telling me what to do. It'll just be me saying, oh, the price going up, I think I'll do something different. That creates demand, and exciting things happen. And by the way, to the legacy cost question, connect these if I may. I want to equip you with a case to be made, especially the champions of free enterprise, is remind them that Milton Friedman said in his book, the title of his book in 1975 was, "There's No Such Thing as a Free Lunch." If we think that we can get away with paying for coal-fired electricity some artificially low price, we are violating Milton Friedman's principle. Because what is the truth is Milton Friedman is right, by golly. There is no such thing as a free lunch, and we are currently paying the full cost of coal-fired electricity. It's just not at the meter. You're paying through an opaque healthcare system for all that soot that ends up in people's lungs. They go to the hospital, you pay on your insurance, in Medicare and Medicaid, and in call shift. You pay all right. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And so what we need to give, really help champions of free enterprise to see is, yeah, that's what we believe. All the cost in, true cost comparison between competing fuels, and then watch what happens. All kinds of innovation happens, and we move away from petroleum, I think. Not that we're out to get petroleum. We're not out to get coal. We're not out to support wind. We're just there to say all cost in, true cost comparison, and the marketplace will sort it out.
We're out of time for questions. Please join me in thanking our guests for an excellent forum.